Committee on Education, Finance, and Economic Competitiveness for February 12th will come to order. The presentation today is Partnership Future. I've heard about P16 since I was given title to this committee, and gee, you should talk to those people with P16, and it took me a while to even know what P16 meant, but I finally got it. Primary, or pre, or something, and 16, I figured, with the new math that we have, I figured that was the 4 years beyond high school. Anyway, Partnership to the Future, P16, Commissioner Segrest.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thanks for doing this. Really appreciate it.
Well, we're really excited to be here, Madam Chair, and members, because the P16 partnership has been kind of a well-kept secret. We've just kind of been working for about the last 5 years diligently, quietly, working on things that will break down barriers and encourage the K-12 and or the P-12 and the 16, the 13 through 16 higher education system to work together to create the opportunities for our students to move through our system a little bit more effectively and efficiently. And so today, what our plan is to, first of all, let President Brunitz and Vice President Linda Baer talk to you about the history, because really these two folks right here, and Chancellor McCormick is unable to be here, but I would say that Chancellor McCormick and President Brunix probably were the two people that were key to establishing the P16 partnership almost 5 years ago. I was really privileged at that time to be a legislator, was invited to the very first meeting at Metro State, where they announced that they were going to establish this P16 partnership. And since that time, they've done some wonderful work. And then I came along as commissioner 2 years ago, and the chairmanship rotates between President Brunix, Chancellor McCormick, and the Commissioner of Education, whoever that may be. And so it was my turn. So 2 years ago, I took the reins of the P16 partnership, and we'll talk a little bit about what we've done the last 2 years. But the most important thing right now is to really let President Brunix and Linda Baer standing in for the chancellor, and Linda also is certainly key to the organization of this too, to talk a little bit about why it came to be and what happened the first 3 years of its existence. And so, President Brunix.
Thank you. Welcome, President Brunix.
Great to be back with you again, and to talk about something that's been a labor of love for all of us. So Chair Murphy, members of the committee, I do have very vivid memories of the first meeting at Metropolitan State. It wasn't just a meeting. It's actually a working session where we brought people in from across the United States to talk about the importance of the links between K-12 or pre-K-12 and higher education. And I think we had probably roughly 150 people at that first founding session to come together and really talk about the importance of working across the public and private systems in pre-K-12 as well as higher education. I was reminded last week how important this conversation is when I picked up a speech delivered by Chairman Bernanke, who is the chair of the Federal Reserve Bank, and he gave this speech in Omaha, Nebraska. And the entire focus of the speech was the relationship between education, the development of human capital, and competitiveness for the United States and the world economy. And he really made the point that economists have known for years there's just a tremendous rate of return from investing in education and training at all levels, you know, throughout the lifespan. And he made that point, I thought, very powerfully. But this was very much an effort to bring people together who really have a lot in common, have common interests, We've had a long history of working with the pre-K-12 system on preparation standards for higher education. We've consulted on the development of tests and curriculum. But this was an effort to try to get these organizations together on a voluntary basis, identify a set of issues that we thought were really important, including policies that occasionally come to the legislature, and agreeing to meet on a very regular basis over this five-year period to really address serious issues that we thought needed to be considered. And it now includes something like 19 to 20 different organizations and groups. Linda will talk to you much more about how it's been evolved. It was formed in 2003, and I think it was the idea started over a breakfast meeting that Linda, I know, attended with Chancellor McCormick, myself, and probably David Laird, if I'm not mistaken, and some of our colleagues from the K-12 system. And we just felt it was important to bring parts of our system together. In the early days, people traveled to different parts of, around or different places in the country to study other models and to bring the best practices that we could back to the state of Minnesota. Much of our work has been around issues of college readiness. How do we get young people better prepared for success in post-secondary education and training programs? Some of the topics have dealt with the education and continuing education of teachers, the important issues of transition from high school to post-high school life, a whole range of issues that we felt were important to address at that time. Linda is going to talk a little bit about the work plan and some of the priorities that we've set, and we're going to segue to you to talk about what's going on now with Susan Egan, right?
Thank you. Vice Chancellor Baer, welcome.
Thank you, Chair Murphy. Very happy to be here. I think this is a very exciting report because it takes all of us working together to truly meet the needs that are going to be there for our students. And this group decided that each one of us alone couldn't do this. We had to be together to work better for the success of our students. And so what you find before you is the work of over really 14 founding members in this partnership. And I'd just like to relate what the 14 looked like, because this is really important. We had the Minnesota State Colleges Universities, we had the University of Minnesota, the Office of Higher Education, Minnesota Private College Council, Minnesota Career College Association, Association of Colleges for Teacher Education, the Minnesota Minority Education Partnership, the Minnesota Department of Education, the Minnesota Association of School Administrators, the Association of Secondary Principals, Elementary Principals, School Boards, Education Minnesota, and Minnesota PTA. So these were the founding members, and these were the people that came together to say, together we can set an agenda to help improve upon readiness and improve upon our opportunities for our students. More recently, we've worked on some e-mentoring projects to help our teachers in their first 3 years of practice, because we know that we lose our teachers in that first 3 to 5 years, most likely. And so together, we found ways to better support newly graduated teachers. And we began planning for possible aligned math tests and research on developmental education. And those are sort of in the formative years. More recently, between 2005 and 2007, we've targeted 6 working groups' efforts, each with a charge focused on a key dimension of college work preparation and transitions. And so you'll see that we're doing those work, that kind of work, in relation to a P16 identification system that Susan Hegard will speak a little more about, college access programs, coordination of web-based career information sites. We have several in the state. Could we work better together on a coordinated opportunity? A remediation study and action plan, aligning math assessment, and college work readiness, the knowledge and skills required. So that's a brief overview of some of the work that this collaboration has taken on as its charge.
Thank you. Representative Hegard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my question has to do with the organizational aspect, either for Ms. Byer or for President Brunix. why P16? Why not? Why was it that we left out the community colleges and the VOTEC schools in the discussion? Was there any intent there? One of the reasons why I bring it up, I found an astounding number, 88% of the, or 82% of first graders do not graduate from college nationwide. That's a serious issue to me. And when I look at the governor's initiative in the senior year now, the pathways in the eighth grade and this initiative of getting some of these vocational classes offered in the high school, at the high school itself, why weren't these two groups included?
Chair Murphy and Representative
Chancellor Baird.
We have the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities at the table. We represent the 32 colleges, Technical Community College and State University, so they are there.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As Vice Chancellor Baird mentioned, our last 2 years have been working very aggressively in six areas, and we want to kind of go through those a little bit more in depth with you. And one of the things I do want to mention to you, we have been, I was recently out at the Chief State School Officers meeting, and there were a couple of governors there. One was Governor Napolitano, and another one was Governor Sebelius. And they happened to overhear a conversation about our Minnesota P16. In fact, she heard via the grapevine of all the work that we've been doing and wanted to know how we were organized and how much we got paid and if there was an appropriation at the state level and everything. And I just, you know, with a very straight face said, Governor Napolitano, this is all voluntary. We just come together and everything that we do is in kind. And she goes, no. And I said, yeah. And I said, we've really got some really great and exciting things that we've done. But I think for us, it just really demonstrates the, I think, commitment that we have had as institutions that we are going to work together, that we have incredible expertise in each one, in all of our institutions that are represented around the table, and that every one of those institutions was willing to donate, if you will, their expertise to whatever the work group is or whatever the thing that we've decided to do as a partnership. And I think it's just a great credit that we've been able to do that. We're not coming here today to ask for any money. We are committed to doing this, and we will continue to work as hard as we can for the benefit of all of our kids. The first work group that Vice Chancellor Baird mentioned was the P16 student ID system. And we decided that if we were going to look at the success of our students, we have some reports that we were able to gather data around, but we are not able to track our students when they graduate from high school. And what happens to them when they stay in our state and go to any of our colleges, whether it's a public or a private college, whether it's a for-profit or proprietary, if you will, school. And so what we decided to do was to say, why not take the student ID number that is attached to our students now and let that track with the students as they go on into whatever college that is here in Minnesota. And Susan Hegard, who's going to be talking to you in a few minutes, chaired that committee. And I want her to kind of go through what happened and just kind of give you an insight as to how one of these work groups met. But this is happening. There's an agreement that has been solidified, and we'll be going forward with this over the next couple of years with our expertise in both of all of our areas, our techie people and the folks that are working with our data privacy, etc. We'll have all of that put in place and ready to go in a couple of years. The second group then, and so then that will help us with research. We'll be able to really, many times we get requests from out of the state, well, you know, how many students are graduating with a degree in science or math or whatever, and we really have a hard time except to be able to survey each individual school and call them up and say, you know, what is your college graduate? That's very difficult. We'll be able to house that information and do some really exciting things with that information. The second group is what we call our College Access Programs group, and you have a very distinguished representative beside you, Representative Murphy, Carlos Mariani, who also works for the, or is the executive director for the Minnesota Minority Education Partnership. His organization had already been working on surveying the college access programs in Minnesota. And I said, well, why not, after we survey those college access programs, establish criteria for some of the exemplary programs that we could highlight and encourage districts and schools and children and our college volunteers who usually staff these kinds of programs, encourage them to participate in some of the exemplary programs. So Carlos's charge then was to not only survey and get kind of a breadth and depth of what we have to offer in the state of Minnesota, but also to establish criteria that we, that a district could then look at and say, okay, this would be a good program for our students. The third group is the Remediation Study and Action Plan, and is it Vice President Mariana? Associate, I, they've got all these titles at the University of Minnesota, has been doing a remediation study, and this has been very, very important work because his group has been looking at what is driving remediation, who is being remediated, who's requiring it, but what are the things, what are the causes that we can analyze and then try to prevent remediation. So if we have programs in our middle school or high school that are not preparing our students to do well in math, what are the kind of strategies then that we can use? So that remediation study is just about done. We've got about another 6 months of work to do, and then we're probably going to kick off another work group to talk about what are the best practices in remediation, but what are the things that we can do to prevent it in the first place. The fourth group is has been a very critical group and has been key to our math revision process that we have right now. We had the charge of looking at our standards, and we started with math and language arts, and we're going to be moving to science next, to look at whether our standards are college ready or preparing our students for, and I should say post-secondary ready, because we looked at college and work ready, and as the group analyzed that, they really felt like there was not too much difference between being work ready and college ready, especially for those kinds of employment opportunities that required higher skill. Even though they were entry level, if you will, those jobs that we know are going to be important to a successful career really have not much difference in those levels of readiness. So this group also worked with Achieve at the national level and went to Washington, D.C. three times. It took our standards that we have now and did some very intensive work at the national level comparing what we have and what we could do to improve our standards. And that work then is now informing our math revision process. It will inform our language arts process in a few years, and it will also inform our science process. But that work has been just extraordinary. And if you look in the back of your packet of information, you can see the list of people that have actually participated in these work groups. And the expertise that is in, that has, you know, been in this, on these work groups is just very extraordinary, very high level expertise. Then we also decided to look at whether we could use our 11th grade math test for a placement test, as if a student scored at a certain level, would the University of Minnesota, would MINSU, would the private accept a certain cut score as acceptable as a kind of a de facto placement test. Now, we're in the process right now with that to put that on hold because we've just given the math test 1 year. We want to have 2 or 3 years of information, but we've had the commitment by all of these institutions to look at it, to consider it maybe as a as part of their transcript of indicating that students have been well prepared and have scored sufficiently that they would be able to take some entry-level math courses if they proceeded to the university or MINSU or a private institution. And finally, the last one is we had the question. We have several websites that help students, our parents, our job seekers, who want to try to figure out what they want to do either in their career planning, or maybe they have left high school and are looking for a job and want to know what kind of educational experience they need to have before they get a job, or if they're in high school, what's the kind of college work or post-secondary courses do they need to take to be well prepared. So we had a NIN Careers website that was run by Deed. We had MSIS, which is our little career planning program at the Department of Education. And then we also had iSeek, which was a web-based tool that students and parents and counselors could use. And we said, why not consolidate these or put them in a one-stop shop? So we've had that process of analyzing that, and we've kind of come to some conclusion about what we want to do with those career websites and how we may want to integrate those in the future. But I hope that you understand what we've been trying to do is to try to break down barriers, try to make everything much more seamless and evolving for students so that they could have many, many multiple opportunities to have success in both high school or in the K-12 system, and then as they move through and transition into the post-secondary world. And a lot of these initiatives are going to allow us to help students become more successful in doing these particular kinds of things, or creating these kinds of systemic changes that will allow our kids to be more successful. I'm going to let Susan kind of tell a little bit about her job, and then I do want to recognize we've got Carlos Mariani here, who headed up his work group. We've got Jeff Mariana, who headed up his remediation study. We have Cindy Crist, who I think is in the audience. She was the chair of the college readiness program, and I don't know if there's anyone else here. And then Linda was the IC chair, and then Susan was the student ID chair. So I think we have everybody represented except for the MAP alignment, and that came out of my department, and that one is sort of on hold. We've kind of made our decision about what we're going to do with that for the time being. So I'm going to hand it over to Susan now.
Thank you, Ms. Eager.
Madam Chair and members, thank you. My name is Susan Hegard. I'm the director of the Minnesota Office of Higher Education. I haven't had the pleasure of being before your committee yet. For those of you who don't know, we are a cabinet agency, about 3 years old now. We were an independent agency before, and before that a coordinating board. And about 70 or so employees at our office. We have some large programs, one of the largest need-based grant programs for financial aid in the country, a loan program that offers a competitive interest rate for students who need to borrow money, Minnesota students. We also oversee reciprocity agreements. We're involved with policy and budget, and I work with these folks here often. Anyway, what I was asked to do, and I also wanted to, was talk with you about this student ID group that I was asked to head up. One of the questions I suppose people might have is, well, why on earth do you need to collect more data? You know, and why would you need to do that? Well, it's not that we need to connect more necessarily, it's that we need to connect it. And there's an organization called the Data Quality Campaign. For those of you who haven't seen this document, it's called Measuring What Matters. And I thought, just to set a little context, it would be useful to tell you some of the reasons, share with you some of the reasons why we might want to have this data system. It would help us follow students' academic progress as they move from grade to grade and then on to college. It would determine value-added and efficiencies of specific schools and programs. Identify consistently high-performing schools so that educators and the public can learn best practices and share them. Evaluate the effect of teacher preparation and training programs on student achievement. And focus school systems on preparing a higher percentage of students to succeed in rigorous high school courses, college, and challenging jobs. Those are just some of the reasons set forth in this document. And they also say that in order to do something like this, you need to have an identifier number. Now, what does that mean? Well, people, I think, automatically think, oh, yikes, you know, a Social Security number. No, that's not so. We basically sat down, a group of us, and you've got the roster, I think. You've got an outline. It's not the latest update, but it's on this buff sheet. And there's a roster that shows who was in our group. We had representatives from the private K-12 schools, the public K-12 schools, all of the public and private higher ed systems. We had some folks with expertise in data privacy issues, et cetera, on our group, and then some technical folks who helped us work through the nitty-gritty of all of this. We met for about 9 months and kind of started at point A. So we looked at the data that's currently collected, and then we for K-12, and then we looked at the data that is collected for higher education. We found a fair amount of duplication between the two. We then decided, well, we don't need all of this data. Let's pick and choose which things we really want to collect and for what purpose. So it wasn't just a big scoop of all this data. It was very selective. So we did that with the existing data that's collected by both agencies. And then we listed out the data that we, new data that we wanted to collect, and I will share some of that with you. The new data that we're proposing to add to what's currently collected would, and we would be basically building off of the MARS number, the Minnesota, help me, what is the acronym? It's the acronym for the current number that all public K-12 students have. So basically we'd be adding a field to the current MARS number. Higher education would be doing that, and we could take that number and follow the student into higher education. You don't have to use the Social Security number. That's not any part of this. It's just the state MARS number that's currently in existence. The new data that we'd be adding would be on both sides. There'd be some new data on our side. We'd be adding the high school GPA to our data source data bank. College GPA, SAT scores, ACT scores, high school rank, advanced standing credits, granted date matriculated, college graduation, access, programs that the student had participated in, TRIO, admission possible, etc., to see whether those things actually made a difference. Participation in college preparatory courses like PSEO, AP, IB, college in the schools, and concurrent enrollment. So we all came to an agreement basically on the data that we would collect, new and old, and then decided that it would be possible to work through this administratively. I think one of the benefits to the way that we did this is that everybody's in, the public and the private college students are in. At the federal level, this had been attempted, and it was torpedoed at the last minute because there were some people very concerned about the federal government collecting information. It was mainly coming from the private college students. So what we did is we decided that we would try a Minnesota-grown effort here. And so far, I think we've had everybody pleased, the private colleges and the public colleges. We've actually, I'm going to go speak to the private K-12 schools next week, this week actually. I'm pleased to be doing that on Wednesday. I think I'm going to talk with them about it. So we're very close, I think, to sort of having a final agreement reached among us all. And I think it'll be a great benefit to both public and private K-12 and higher education.
Ms. Hegard, when did they get this number?
The MARS number, the M-A-R-S-S, correct me if I'm wrong, that number, a child would get that number when they're in kindergarten.
Yeah.
Isn't that correct? So it would be in kindergarten. Every public K-12 student in Minnesota has a number attached to them. And when they leave, and then if they come back, that number is still there. They may leave and go to the private, to a private school and come back to public, or they may stay in public the entire time. But then what we'd basically be doing is just attaching a field onto that current number so that higher education could include their data. The Department of Education would send us a data file at our agency, and we'd put that information all together in one place.
Will the parents give approval of that number?
That's part of the data privacy issue, and so what we would be doing, it's called a Tennyson warning, for those of you who are familiar with that, and we'd be doing a warning as we do now when data is collected to all students, and that would be facilitated through the K-12 folks.
And when does the non-public student or the homeschool student, when do they get their number?
Well, they would have to opt in, Madam Chair. That's not something that would happen automatically, and I think that's part of the reason why I've been asked to speak to the K-12 private students and the schools, that they would have to opt in and decide that this was something of value. I think in some cases they will think that it will be. I think in other cases there are families and students who will not want to opt in. But right now this number exists just for public K-12 students.
Thank you. And Commissioner Segrin, could you said that at the beginning David Laird was involved, and David Laird is with the private colleges, is that correct? And so how much has the private colleges participated in the P16 partnership?
Madam Chair, the private colleges have been equal participants all the way through. They're at the partnership. In fact, what we also have is an executive team, a P16 executive team, and this is a smaller group that just, you know, goes over, you know, what our agenda is going to be for the partnership meetings, vets some of the issues that we're going to be talking about to see if we want to move them forward, et cetera. And David Laird from the private colleges is an executive team member, as well as President Brunick, Chancellor McCormick, myself, Susan Hegard. We have Education Minnesota. I'm going to miss a couple of people now. Citizens League is on a partnership. The Career Colleges is on the group, in the group. I'm missing one other person. I think superintendents are part of the executive team. So we have the executive team, and the privates are just as equal a partner, as well as the, I always call them the for-profit institutions, the public institutions that are there too. So we really had a very good, really strong working relationship and a very positive relationship with everyone on the partnership.
President Brunick.
Chair Murphy, members of the committee, if I could just make a couple of additions to comments that have been made. About 2 years ago, we decided to expand the membership of the P16 partnership, invited representatives of Minnesota businesses to join us, major nonprofits, including the Citizens League, and Minnesota foundations, who are really investing very heavily in K-12 reform and related issues. And I think that's really broadened the scope of conversation and made these conversations much richer. It's also allowed us to learn from one another in setting the agenda regarding work that we really think needs to be done. And I think it's been really a healthy development. The other thing I should say is when we started this effort, we made a deliberate decision not to come here and ask for money. We decided that we were going to join together, and whatever was necessary to fund our work or support our work, we were going to raise ourselves. We didn't want to compete with any other agendas. And so on occasion, there's a project that requires more than in-kind support. We have actually raised some money, sometimes by passing the hat and sometimes by writing a proposal, but I think it's worked relatively well. We didn't know in the beginning whether we could sustain this effort, but what I find remarkable is all the partners that started in 2003 are still enthusiastic supporters of this effort and show up regularly and regularly enlist their colleagues in the various task forces. The question was asked. Even you asked the question about the 2-year college system. The leaders of those great colleges in Minnesota are a part of all these task forces, and so we've tried to really make these working groups highly representative and inclusive of the people who really ought to be around the table working on these serious issues of improving preparation, transition, and success in high school and beyond.
Representative Heidgertkin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You're getting better with it all the time.
I just have to keep saying.
So what you got
to
do is what these Norwegians out in Polk County do when they see me. They go, Heidgertkin. But anyways, Madam Chair, thank you. And my question, President Brunick, may be for the young man sitting behind you. My question has to do with the remedial studies, and I've read the last couple, and I've found from 05 to 04 to 03, we have seen the results are much better. And I have a couple questions in regards to that. Are the results better? We're finding that the students are better prepared. Are the results better because we defined what we want for readiness? Or has it been because we're doing just a better job? I know their ACT scores are very well and everything else. Are we doing a better job? And the second question has to do with how do we do with other states in comparison? Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And is that Heidgertkin?
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you. Sorry.
Please identify yourself.
I'm Jeff Mariama. I'm Associate Vice President for System Academic Administration at the University of Minnesota. And I'm one of the co-chairs of the remedial working group within the B16 partnership. Are you talking about the Getting Prepared reports right. that you've been watching? Yeah, those reports, you know, are done by our system office and by the Minnesota system office. And so what our goal is to take a particular group of students in one graduating class and follow those students back into high school, go back into their records, go into the high school system and look at those students on their basic standards test, their Minnesota high school, Minnesota comprehensive assessment tests, and to the extent we can, course taking, other information like that, try to see where we can predict whether or not students will take developmental or remedial courses, that is college courses that are below a college level and that students won't get college credit for, courses that we presume they would have background in order to be ready to take college classes. At this point, it's taken us a while to get all the data agreements to use the high school data, the Minnesota data, the university data together, and we're there and we're starting to do the data analysis. So I can only talk from previous studies, but the pilot studies we did, which were done in single districts. And the first one we did, when we looked at what the predictors were of taking those classes, were actually what we found was the 8th grade basic standards test for university students was as good a predictor as was the ACT test score. Plus that said, we need to look early. This isn't things that are happening to students when they're in 10th and 11th grade, it's things that's happening to students earlier. We also found those students were in the lower half of their high school class. So these are students who you might think of as aspiring to go to college, students who a generation or two ago wouldn't have gone to college. And so part of it is we need to think, and I think where that takes us is it takes us to the point that our Consortium for Postsecondary Academic Success is working on, which is how do you get all students ready for college? And that's where Cindy Chris works with as well on what are college readiness expectations and standards, working college readiness. And so a lot of these things fit together. But so the early message is where we need to look early, we need to think about getting more kids ready for college. The second one, done in a different district and looking at students taking remedial developmental classes, found that if you use thresholds, if you look at courses that students take and you look at how well they do in those classes, it's important to get students not just to take the challenging courses, and you know there's a lot of legislation now about, you know, getting students into challenging courses, but also to have them do well in those courses. That if we look at the courses that students take and impose a criterion of a grade of D or better, which of course is a pass, we can't tell who will and who won't take those classes. If we impose a level of C or better, we can't tell. As soon as we impose a level of B or better, then we can tell who's going to take remedial courses and who isn't. So it's important not only that students take the classes, but they understand they need to do well and get proficient in those courses in order for them really to benefit them. So those are the early things that we found out of that work group. We're getting to the point where I think we can get to the real question that you wanted to ask is, if the percent of students taking courses is going down, why are they going down? What are the things that are happening? Is it better preparation? Is it more rigorous standards? Is it no child left behind? Is it more frequent testing? We can't sort all that out yet, but we hope to be able to do a lot of that.
And Chair, thank you. Again, I don't think we're really, when you do the studies itself, and I've looked at both the studies, mm-hmm. and we're not looking at, I'm a former high school English teacher. You're not, I can teach linguistics to seniors. And the seniors will look at that course and they know it's going to be quite difficult. They'll look at perhaps an opportunity to take American authors as another choice. But my point being is that we're not looking at the crux of the problem. Students need, in order to get scholarships, in order to apply for scholarships, get scholarships to colleges. It's oftentimes based upon school rank and not necessarily on courses they take. And I think that's an issue that's never really addressed. I know, for example, I just had my third son graduate from college. And I have the fourth son that's going to a tech school. He avoided taking the tough courses to stay on the B honor roll, a B plus honor roll. It's much easier taking a general ed course and getting an E and keeping your rank up than taking Algebra 3. I mean, has that ever been addressed? I mean, that's the crux of the problem at the high school level.
Chairman Murphy, President Hagar, I think if you look at admissions at the University of Minnesota, what you'll see is the most important thing is the courses that students take, and that's the best predictor of success. So I would never tell a student, take easy courses and get good grades because your rank is most important. It's not. And taking easier courses won't help your test performance. It won't help you as you get ready for college. And as we go through the review process, we track the courses that students take.
Yeah. Chair Murphy, you got
Representative Brunick.
Representative Heidelbergen. You weren't teaching this course in Norwegian, were you?
German, sir. Thank you.
German. No, I'm sorry. You said Norwegian earlier. Anyway, if you take a look at college success, that is student retention and graduation rates, the best single predictor that people have found is taking 4 years of rigorous mathematics. Just to take one particular indicator. So one of the things that the private colleges, the Minsky colleges and universities and University of Minnesota did some years ago, actually as far back as 1988, is we came together and we tried to define what the preparation standards should be for entry into colleges and universities. And, our two-year college system is more of an open access system than our four-year college systems, public and private. But we found soon after those standards were promulgated that students changed their course-taking behaviors across the high schools of Minnesota. And I was recently in Austin, Albert Lee, and visited the Austin High School and talked to teachers and superintendent there. And basically, they told me in a meeting, keep harping on what courses students should take and what they should know and be able to do to get into our colleges and universities, because that's the best help you can give us in the classroom here in Austin, Minnesota. And so we've revised those standards. We recently at the University of Minnesota put in a writing requirement as part of the admissions battery that students have. It takes us more time, more money to process the applications, but we were noticing that, and maybe it's the internet age, I don't know, but that our students were less interested in writing, and our faculty kept saying they don't write as well as we used to. So we basically put in a very rigorous writing requirement throughout the University of Minnesota system, but we thought we ought to also emphasize that it's important to think about these issues in high school. So I think that's part of what this P16 partnership does. People come together and they say, okay, what are the issues on the critical path to getting young people better prepared for post-high school careers? How can we help make them more successful? How can we really reach audiences that don't have the same possibility? I was talking to my youngest son at the dinner table. He said, you know how tough it is to be in a house with two parents who are PhDs? He said, this is impossible. And that's a different kind of environment than a lot of the households in Minnesota. And I'll just finish with one quick story. I was in Henry High School one time, and university adopted Henry as a partnership school. And I think our faculty and students have done some marvelous things there. But early in the game, I was in a ninth grade class, and I said, how many young people are going to college? And about 9 out of 10 hands went up. And so how many have taken or plan to take Algebra 1 this year? And about a third of the hands went up. So already in the ninth grade, as Jeff is talking about, these young people had made choices that put them on the wrong path for where they needed to be 3-4 years following my question, if they plan to go to the University of Minnesota or any of the other public or private four-year institutions in the state. So I think that's a lot of what motivated us to come together. We felt we could figure out ways by working together to be really helpful to the K-12 system, to be also looking after our own self-interest. It's in our self-interest to have young people better prepared, so we're spending our time and money on the right things. And it's also in the state's best interest for us to work more effectively together.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Brunich, you made a wonderful segue into the question that I was going to ask. Has this group given any consideration to the issue of counseling that goes on in both junior high and the high school? And that regards career exploration as well as academic counseling, because I think you all know the statistics about counselors and how important that is in terms of getting students thinking about what coursework they need to take, even as early as the middle school years, not waiting till the high school years. And we're in we really, really need, I think, to do a much better job. Have you done any discussion of that? Have you investigated what impact that makes in terms of a student's success later on in terms of college or remediation courses?
Chair Murphy and Representative Peterson, we have a very powerful website called iSeek.org, www.iseek.org, and iSeek stands for the Internet System for Employment and Education Knowledge. And it's yet another partnership. And in that, if you go to that site and you have someone interested in being an English major, it will reflect what you need to take in high school to be ready to be an English major and which schools offer English majors. It will tell you if you think you want to be a chemist, what you need to be taking and where you can take chemistry. You can also say if you're a chemistry person where you might be able to find work. So it's a pretty nice combination website. We know we don't have enough counselors and career information people on site. We try the best we can in the K-12 to do that. This is a supplemental opportunity where people do get information. We also publish a very, very comprehensive NIN careers book, and we've kept it in hard copy print because the counselors that are there at the schools working very hard use this all the time, and we even have it in multiple languages.
Madam Chair.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, also to answer Representative Peterson's question about the level of counselor ratio. Certainly it is not good, and we need to improve that. One of the things that the governor has proposed this year is a $75 million ongoing appropriation for high schools that every high school would be eligible for. Part of that high school proposal is to require a personal graduation plan, and that would be started in eighth grade so that the students would be looking at that. St. Paul, I must compliment St. Paul, already has what they call their six-year plan where they start with their seventh graders and help them plan for their high school course taking and looking beyond that to their post-secondary. Part of the high school monies would also go to not only developing a personal graduation plan, but would be enhancing the counseling system, would also be using college access programs. We know that the counselors, don't have the physical capacity to perhaps organize groups of students to practice the ACT, but a college access program adjunct to a counseling system could come in to help students do that. We also know that there are lots of innovative ways to use college access programs with the, and I always look at the counselor as being the doctor, if you will. They're going to be using the physician assistance, which would I call the college access programs, to identify the students. The counselors would identify the students that would need the support, maybe the tutoring. They have the potential, the ability. We can just help them, but they need some tutoring. For many of us, we know the system, how to work the system. You know that you got to get the kid practicing the SAT or the ACT. You know that the financial aid forms are complicated, but many of us have the skills to figure that out. But a lot of first-generation families, and if you have parents that don't speak English, who are just coming here for the first time and want that and desire that for their children, but don't know how to access the system. There are a number of college access programs that actually provide bilingual support so that they organize maybe a Hispanic group of parents in an evening to get together to help with financial aid. So there's lots of components that you can create, and part of the governor's plan would provide some money to implement some of those strategies to come alongside our kids. To help them think about their post-secondary opportunities and career plans.
Thank you. Representative Wardlow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This might be to President Brunix or to Mr. Maruyama, but you when you commented that it takes 4 years of mathematics, that's a huge predictor as to they go on to college and be successful. You know, when our in early childhood studies, we see that our third and fourth graders, our fourth graders, their test scores rank way high up compared to other countries. And then as they hit middle school years and high school years, they go down. And I'm just wondering, when people, given 90% of the kids seem to want to go to college, the fact that you said, President Brunix, you need 4 years of math, and all of a sudden, apparently kids start taking math and higher skilled courses. I'm wondering if that is going to have a reflection, and maybe as the you study remediation, you'll start discovering things related to how we can make those test scores go up in the middle and high school years. Don't know if that helps us yet with the education gap, but it seems encouraging to me. And by the way, I do like the choice. I'm excited about the new football coach.
President Brunick.
Chair Murphy, Representative Wardlow, I may be more equipped to handle the second part of your comment than the first.
That's
but let me give it a try. I agree with you. But anyway, I do think if you look at these international comparisons, it is clear that our students do better in the fourth grade test than they do in the, let's say, the NAEP eighth grade test and the high school test. And particularly in areas of mathematics and science, our curriculum is more broadly based than the curriculum, for example, you would find in China or India or Japan, and they tend to focus much more than we do in reinforcing the curriculum. It's sort of a spiral throughout the school years, and we're sort of less attentive to those issues, and we're less attentive to really emphasizing mathematics and science. And so there's a major national movement to begin addressing those issues, in the National Competitive Initiative that has been rolled out by the National Academy of Science, and many others have talked about this gap, this growing gap between educational performance in the United States and other countries of the world. And I do think it's something we really have to pay attention to. I think Representative Peterson's question about counselors, the role of counselors, I think we have underinvested in some of these areas. We obviously have to figure out some more creative ways of getting that kind of support, particularly to young students who do not have the benefit of parents who regularly ask them all these questions and help them get prepared. But it is a real issue. We should be doing better, and I think we clearly can if we continue to work on improving our educational systems. But we aren't as rigid in terms of the structure of the curriculum in American schools as you find in other countries throughout the world. And you also find that the college and university students who go into U.S. colleges and universities in many cases have a more creative spark than you'll find in the student bodies. And some that doesn't mean they're more bright or more intelligent or less intelligent, but I mean, we do encourage our kids to think more broadly, more diversely about issues, more creatively in some ways. And I think it pays off when you look at the resilience of the U.S. workforce. Study after study has shown remarkable adaptability and productivity in the U.S. workforce, and there are a lot of reasons for it. But I don't know if there's a single kind of solution, but I would say that you put your finger on something we ought to worry about and we ought to work on and we ought to make, we ought to improve.
Madam Chair.
Commissioner.
Just to also make a comment, one of the reasons we've been so strong in the United States in our innovation and our creativity is the fact that we have consistently turned out a lot of engineers. Over the last 10, 15, 20 years, however, we have really slipped in that area. And just in our technology design, engineering, and programs, we are really losing ground. And that's one reason why, really, this is so critical. If we don't make the decision to really talk more seriously about science and mathematics and exposing ourselves and actually demanding that our children take higher levels, we are going to lose our edge competitively, innovatively, and creatively in the United States. We have got to do this, and we cannot wait another year or another month. We really have to do it. Many of our schools are doing some very exciting things, but we have to build the capacity in our high schools. For example, Project Lead the Way is a wonderful example. Very comprehensive, four-year pre-engineering type of program that is a career and technical opportunity that is for every student, really gets the kids involved hands-on with design concepts. Burnsville, for example, in their seventh grade, when students are supposed to be doing shop and what's home ed called now? I'm sorry.
Family life science.
Yeah, there you go. The Burnsville school district is requiring that all of their seventh grades take the introductory Project Lead the Way course. And I visited the other day, and I was out there with the seventh graders, and it was just a blast because they were designing the little pine box derby cars, but they were doing it on their computer with CAD, computer-aided design. And last year, the winning car went 25 miles an hour, and so they were trying to beat that winning time. And then they were going to go into the shop class and actually make the little pine box cars. But what was really cool, as I was walking through the classroom, and I started to help these kids. I figured out how to put some of the wheels on and do all this kind of cool stuff. There was a young lady there, seventh grader, and I asked her, I said, well, do you like being in this class? And she goes, I love this class. This is the class that I look forward to my whole week, my whole day. This is the class that I can't wait to come to. And so she had figured out her car, and she had it all modeled, but there was this little guy next to her that couldn't figure out how to manipulate the program in his mouth and everything to get his car, his wheels clicked on to his chassis. And so she said, I'll help you do this. And so it was just really cool to see the interaction of kids that maybe wouldn't have talked to each other in the hallway, but this course was really bringing them together, and they were talking together, they were working together and trying to figure out how to make these pine box cars. But it's just an example of what we really need to do. When we survey kids, eighth graders, there's only about 10% of our eighth graders who say they have any interest in going into any kind of design, engineering, technology, science. It jumps up about double that in 10th grade, but 20% of all of our kids, only that many, one out of five have an interest in these concepts. We are going to lose our edge, and we will not be the creative country that we were before if we don't get more kids involved and engaged in these disciplines. And that's why our work as the P16 partnership has been so critical. We are so committed to working together as institutions across and breaking down those barriers. If we can, help our high school teachers professionally develop and engage their kids in a more relevant way, we want to do that. They certainly have a lot of skill and research that we can bring into our classes, but we want to be able to talk back and forth and utilize our expertise to do that. So it's critical, and we're putting some money into, we're proposing putting money into teacher science and math academies, and also into some mentor programs for our teachers too. Number of critical things that we feel that we need to do to build capacity. As President Brunick said, by 8th grade our scores are flat, and by 12th grade we're at the bottom of the pack internationally in our scores. Now that's not everything. We can't measure everything we do on that, but our countries that used to be third world countries are fast moving on the educational stage. They are fast educating their students, and they're being very aggressive. Their students are hungry to learn, because they know that this is their economic future. And our kids need to have that hunger to succeed also, just for the future of our country.
Chancellor Baer.
Chair Murphy, I wanted to point out, recently I saw a chart that showed that our students who take AP math are at the top of the international list and so it shows you what happens with the rigor that's expected, then they perform very, very well. It's also evident that about third to fourth grade is when students start perceiving themselves either being good at math or not being good at math. And it's a mental image that they carry around with themselves. We have an interesting thing where a student came and presented from Normandale Community College to our Board of Trustees. He said, I'm a non-traditional student. I came to school late in time, and I hated math. I just hated math. And this advisor and that faculty member showed me that math loved me. Math loved me. He ended up being a math major, and he's going to go on in his career now. But there's part of our problem is kind of a math phobia that comes in very early on, and that's one of the things that we have as a challenge to work on.
Representative Riley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have two questions. One, what kind of vetting went through this group, if any, for the governor's proposal on world languages, recommending four, whereas the higher ed institutions, my understanding, require two? And then secondly, what are you doing about the P in P16? Every time I ask about that, not much, but is there anything yet?
Madam Chair.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, we didn't have a discussion of the 4 years of foreign language. We certainly have had discussions in the past about the importance of foreign language, and that students need to take as much as possible. We certainly are interested in feedback from the legislature also, because we also are looking at immersion programs that start early in the young years and move forward, or you could, you know, we're not trying to say which is best, if you will, but we really believe that exposing students to foreign languages either early or as much as possible is really important for their ability to learn, too. We know that there's a connection, and perhaps Vice Chancellor Baer or President Bruning wants to comment on the foreign language.
Well, Madam Chair, I'd like to hear the both answers to both questions, too.
President Brunick.
Yeah. Chair Murphy, Representative Greiling. I think at least at the university, we're doing everything we can to work with schools to improve language instruction throughout the state. We have a special interdisciplinary center on language acquisition that works on these issues all the time. So we're obviously very much in favor of trying to strengthen standards in that area. Whether Minnesota schools have the current capacity to deliver on that expectation, I think, is something that you probably need to examine. I think we probably need to use much more of the power of technology to get the reach of these programs out, particularly in greater Minnesota and in some of our urban centers. Let me talk about the P in the P16 partnership. I happen to have a lot of passion around the issues of development of young children. I thought it was kind of interesting. I mentioned the chairman of the Federal Reserve Bank, who gave really an economic speech on the power and importance of education last week in Omaha. And in his remarks, he went out of his way to cite specific research done here at the Federal Reserve Bank and the University of Minnesota on the benefits and costs of investing in early education, particularly for students who grow up in more economically disadvantageous backgrounds. I'm now chairing the ITASCA Group's Early Childhood Report. We're working with the MELF Board and with many other organizations to try to put a spotlight on these issues and determine some reform and improvement strategies that we think would really work. And that report will come out relatively soon. But this group does address issues of early development, readiness for school, all the things that I think you're concerned about in this committee. And I'll just share with you that when I was a graduate student, many of the studies that Art Rolnick and his colleagues have used, to model benefits and costs of investing in early education were done in the 1960s and early 70s, at least the most controlled studies. And the estimate is that if you invest properly and you have the right rigor in your programs, you can get a 16-to-1 rate of return. That's a better return than you can get with respect to just about any public investment. But I would also say that we've got some hard work to do in this area. I think we've got to target this investment. I mean, I'd like to I'll be honest with you, I'd like to invest in all areas, you know, when it comes to the early lives of kids. But when you take a look at, for example, the Kansas City studies, the kids in more advantaged areas of the suburbs of Kansas City, this was done in the early 1970s, had 2 to 3 times the working vocabulary of kids in very, very low income environments. And you start kindergarten with half or less of the working vocabulary of kids you're going to school with, then it's very, very hard to keep, you know, to sort of keep pace and keep up. And so I think we really have to take these issues pretty seriously, and we have to target our investment, particularly in, you know, in low-income communities where people need some extra boost and some extra head start in life to get young people ready for school. Now, you go into some of the urban areas and some of the lower income rural areas of Minnesota, and you'll find 60-70% of the kids are not meeting what we consider to be the basic threshold of concepts and understanding they need to be highly competitive when they get into kindergarten and into the first grade. So we're looking at these issues. It hasn't been, it's not a work group right now, but we've had work groups on early education issues, and I think it's fundamentally important. If you don't get a good start in life, you pay compound interest as a society forever.
Chancellor Baer.
Chair Murphy, I could give just a very brief discussion. We have extensive numbers of programs in early childhood. So what we are doing is trying to train the people who will be doing early childhood as we know it now. With some of the No Child Left Behind legislation, the Head Start programs have required increase in certification and education of people. And we've had a number of programs, particularly I know on some of the reservations, where people have been taking compressed courses to end up being able to do really early childhood work, and they've said instead of the babysitting they might have been doing before. So we are working step for step where we can. One of our problems certainly is early childhood is not a highly paid profession at this point, and so there's high turnover in those places. But we do have programs. We can build those programs. I think the state does need to invest in younger age. Particularly would be nice to see mandatory age 3 on opportunities for daycare and early preschool.
Ms. Hegard, do you have any insights on the first part of the question about the world languages?
Madam Chair, I don't have anything further to add other than, I think the points here have been well taken, that there's an increased focus that needs to happen with world language. Our competitors worldwide, those students know 2 and sometimes more languages than their own language. So I think this increased focus is coming at a critical time.
And did anyone on the panel, when we discuss languages and the need for other languages, do we discuss the best time to learn these languages?
Madam Chair.
Commissioner.
I will focus a little bit on the Mandarin Chinese initiative that we've been kind of growing. And one of the things, there have been several things that we've talked about. How do you grow the kind of resources that you need to teach a foreign language? And one of the things that we found with Mandarin Chinese is we got a very vital, rich, thriving Chinese community, Chinese American citizens. And we also, the Board of Teaching has a portfolio process whereby someone who has a bachelor degree from, you know, and maybe let's say an example has been working in the science area, would like to become a teacher, there's a portfolio process whereby they can go and they can share their educational background, their experience in the field, et cetera, and then kind of lay that across a map that will then say, then you need to have these credits if you want to become a teacher. You'll get credit, if you will, for your existing content knowledge, your bachelor's degree or bachelor's, and then your work experience. But then you must go back and do that. And we invited, we had an invitation for anyone interested who was fluent in Mandarin Chinese to possibly come on a Saturday afternoon and explores the, you know, maybe the idea of becoming a foreign language teacher. We had 70 people come that afternoon, and PhDs, people that were just extraordinarily gifted, people very highly educated, who were just very excited about the opportunity, about thinking about getting another degree and teaching a foreign language. So I think we could use, there are a lot of strategies we could use, I think, as we're growing. And it shouldn't be just Mandarin Chinese. It can be learning Spanish, French, German. I'm sure once the governor comes back from India, we're probably going to have a move to expose our kids to those languages, and that's okay. It doesn't have to be any particular language per se, except that we do, you know, have to be cognizant of who we're going to be working with in the future, who our trade partners are going to be too. So there's some strategic reasons why we want to focus on some languages. Japan, of course, we always have kind of our boutique languages that crop up from time to time because of Russian, you know, was popular a few years ago, and then Japanese was. But that's okay. You know, we need to continue to create those opportunities for students. But the bottom line is learning a foreign language really does help you academically. It just exercises that brain in ways that are beneficial to you.
Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to address the kind of, we've been hashing this subject around, and that's the rigor again. And I've got this thought about the options that we give a lot of kids and the choices they take. They can take physics, or they can take some other type of physics that we might have, or they can take chemistry or some other type of chemistry. And I know Superintendent Williams, I think in this committee, Madam Chair, talked about the offerings that they have and reexamining some of those offerings and the rigor that some of them have. And what occurred to me, President Brunix, when you mentioned about talking to the kids about the ninth graders or the 10th graders or the 8th graders and how many of them were going to take algebra going forward, and you said only a third raised their hand, the thought that popped in my head, well, what are they going to take instead? And so what I'm wondering about is, in the P16 group, has there been discussion about what I call the proliferation of offerings that we have? And choice is good, and we want to have a lot of offerings. But I'm afraid sometimes that our offerings are intended to lower the rigor so that, getting back to something that Representative Heidgerken mentioned, lowering the rigor so that more people can get B's and A's as opposed to maintaining rigor and trying to find other ways to maybe provide relevance to help people know some of the things they need to know. Was there discussion in the P16 group any place about that, these proliferation and whether we're maintaining rigor and looking at other ways to get people excited about math and science and that sort of thing?
Madam Chair.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, President Brunix and I are going to double team this one. We are actually, my tenure as the chair is going to be up, and we decided in June, so that because President Brunix is going to be taking over for the next 2 years as chair. And one of the things we're going to be talking about in our next executive team meeting is what are the next work groups, what are the next focuses that we're going to be talking about. And certainly you've given us a suggestion. And I know that there are a lot of expertise in the higher ed area as far as what other countries are doing, how they focus. Should we be more focused in our curriculum? Should we be looking at the breadth and depth of what we offer our students? You know, we really firmly believe, I think, in the United States and particularly in Minnesota, that we want our students to have a liberal arts education. And I firmly believe that that's very important. But you do hit a very important issue. How many offerings do we have? Does that drive costs that we don't necessarily need to have versus having a more discrete and focused curriculum? So it's kind of balancing those, wanting to have a lot of electives and you know, wonderful things for kids to kind of sample, if you will, versus the other. So it could be a possibility.
Representative Kranz.
Yeah. President Brunix. But Chair Murphy, Representative.
Oh, I forgot the last part of
yeah,
the
that's right. Well, it's pretty easy. I get that same sort of like, that's why my middle name is Rodney. But anyway. the comment I guess I would make is the partnership is addressing these issues. A number of the work groups, and I think Commissioner Segrin mentioned them, are really trying to align the expectations, let's say in mathematics, with the expectations that colleges and universities hold for the preparation of students. And so we have college faculty across our systems and public and private institutions who are working on these groups and trying to align their ideas with the obviously the assessments mm-hmm. that occur throughout Minnesota, but also to be really clear about what young people need to know and be able to do in mathematics and science and many of the other fields that we think are highly critical to success in post-secondary education. So I think that's a really good thing, to bring faculty who teach these courses together with high school teachers, counselors, and others to have a serious conversation about what's important. I think one of the problems we have, and this goes back to the earlier question of Representative Wardlow, too, and that is we really believe strongly in local control in this country. And we not only believe strongly in local control across districts, we even believe in local control at the building level in many cases, within districts. And so that is not as characteristic as of other systems, I think, as Commissioner Segrin has said, you know, other countries that have a more standardized curriculum that's sort of a spiral curriculum where you repeat these concepts over and over again. And the biggest achievement fall-offs in a lot of our schools, particularly in the urban areas, are when kids move from one school to another and get thrown into a new classroom situation with new people, but also a new textbook, a new curriculum. And it's extremely difficult to keep the continuity of your academic study up in those cases. So I don't know what the answer is here. There are gains in local control and local autonomy. I appreciate that, and I'm reminded of them every time I go to a meeting at the university. But I do think that we ought to take some of this more seriously. We ought to take a look at the structure of the curriculum, the expectations that we hold of young people. We ought to make those expectations a little clearer to parents. I know it's often challenging to keep these relationships between school and home as strong as they really need to be. But we need a lot more attention on these issues to make sure that in these transitions from fourth grade to the middle school and from eighth grade to the high school, that you don't start to slip and lose the attention of young people as to what's really important to study and what's really important to achieve. And there are lots of different ways of gaining, you know, requirements and so forth, but that doesn't work really very well, to be honest with you. I mean, when people look at transcripts today, they're able to evaluate what's in a course pretty well, and they know the AP curriculum. You know, if they look at a transcript and a young person at the applying to the university's Twin Cities campus has no AP, no international baccalaureate classes, no post-secondary options where they've taken some rigorous curriculum, they can sort that out. And you may have a higher class rank, but if you got there through an easier path, you're not likely to get the same consideration. But that's sort of the wrong end to be focusing on, I think. I think you need to really focus on reform schools first. And I think that's a part of what we ought to do in setting the agenda. This whole national movement around science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, we call it STEM, that's a big issue at the university. We need to get, you know, we're trying to organize something called a consortium on post-secondary success, and we said to all the academic departments across the colleges and universities in the University of Minnesota system, what can we do together to try to address these issues? We have physics force in the Department of Physics. Well, let's get it out there and connect it to the schools. Have our leading scientists get into the schools and work on college in the schools programs. And so I think we need to do a lot more of that to get the attention of young people.
Ms. Heger, did you
want to
get in there?
Madam Chair, not on this particular topic. I do have two things I want to share with you, but before you finish, and I'm happy to do that whenever.
Okay. I have two more questions. Representative Tran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I got 2 points. One, I appreciate President Brunix and your comments. You're making my case for affordable housing in the earlier part of your comments there. Thank you. My question is more directed to the commissioner. as the focus keeps going on math and science and English, I'm curious what the State Department's issues or stance or even future outlook might be for areas like health, FIED requirements, our kids in our supersized mixed schools that they're in right now. We seem to be placing a lot of emphasis on math, science, and the mandates, and we currently have in our middle schools, in some cases, where kids maybe are deficient in those areas, the answer to that is basically they take more. So if you don't pass the math class, guess what? You're now in two math classes. And then they pull them out of other areas, FIED, band, music, social studies. I mean, we're going to end up, as we keep upping the requirements for math and science, kids that haven't even taken a civics course, don't understand their role in government, have no idea what U.S. history and some of the problems that we've faced and mistakes we've made, we're going to be doomed to repeat them again. So I guess I'm concerned about the idea that you made reference to this liberal arts high school education, and as we keep driving the curriculum and take away local control by adding more requirements, I'm confused that, I guess I'm not confused, but concerned that we're trying to make every kid something that they may not be excelling in. So I guess I'll be quiet now and listen to your comments as it relates to the other parts. FIED, health, social studies. Where does that fit in the vision of the future for P16 education?
Madam Chair.
Commissioner.
And Representative Krantz.
Krantz,
I'm sorry.
Thank you.
First of all, you mentioned adding more, and I think what we should be thinking about is creating different opportunities for kids and different requirements. That seems to be what we all often think about when we talk about changing our requirements, that we're adding more on top of, and it really isn't. It is really about redesigning our system so that students, when they're starting in elementary, then through middle school and through high school, the expectation is that it will be a natural flow that they will be requiring to take mathematics that is going to prepare them for a post-secondary opportunity. Now, that could be a technical school, it could be a two-year institution, community college, or four-year, or it could be a trade school. But every one of those opportunities that students are going to be looking at are going to require more mathematics and more scientific knowledge and more technical knowledge. Even in the trades, technology is a big part of what they're using as they're designing a house or whether they're an electrician or a plumber. So we need to think about how we are not adding more on top of, but how we change our curriculum to prepare our students. Now, I really am a very firm believer in a liberal arts education, and I think that as we change and we adjust, and it's going to take some time for our system to change and adjust, it's not going to happen overnight. The requirements that we're talking about are for this year's fourth graders to start to take more rigor, so we need that time to change. But we certainly should be engaging our students in FIED and health and arts, in the fine arts. In fact, we do have a requirement for fine arts. We are looking at, you know, some world languages. So they all should be part of it. Social studies, civics, as you mentioned, should all be part of it. And hopefully as things change, as our curriculum improves, as we come alongside of our teachers that are experienced and help them with professional development opportunities, we'll give them some additional skills to teach and be successful with our kids, that all of these things, well, we won't be, as President Brunix has cautioned us in P16, let's not talk about remediation and how many classes we have to add to our curriculum to remediate, but let's get to the heart of it and prevent remediation by making sure that they start out well-educated coming into kindergarten and then through their early years in elementary, middle school, and high school to build a system that we will have less and less remediation and pull out. But it starts with every area and every system to change that. And we're in the middle of that process now where we know we have to have higher rigor for our kids. We just can't. And our kids, if the little kids that I saw in China who were sitting 70 in a classroom and were packed on a 105-degree day, waiting for 2 hours for us to get to their room because we were late. Our plane was late arriving. They sat there for 2 hours waiting for us, and they were learning English, and they were learning math and science, and they were learning higher levels than some of our kids. If they can do it, and they come from very poor backgrounds, these students just extraordinary backgrounds when you start talking about, you know, where they live and where they're coming from. If they can do it, our kids can do it. Our kids are just as bright and just as capable as anyone in this whole wide world. But we need to set that expectation for them. And I think as Vice Chancellor Bear mentioned, you know, we kind of are a math-averse culture, you know, and science is just for the, you know, the geeks and the nerds, and it isn't. We really need to expose our kids to more of this. It's not that we're all going to be white lab coat people, but we really do need to think about even the spin-off jobs that are created by the Medtronics that need technical expertise, a technical education, a college education. So it's just kind of getting our mind thinking about that. And I know we're talking a lot about STEM, and it seems like that's the only thing we're focused on. Civics is very important. Phi-Ed is very important. And we need to create a system that can support our kids in all of those areas. And I do not mean to diminish those, but we need to keep pushing ourselves. It's an exciting time educationally, and it's very demanding and frustrating.
Follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, I appreciate your commitment to liberal arts education and look forward to more of that in the future.
Thanks.
Ms. Hegarth, your 2 points.
2 points, just quickly. There are a couple more things I was thinking about that we've all been involved in. The first is the college encouragement campaign. The focus is to encourage students to understand the importance of college and the steps needed to get there. We've all put a little bit of money in towards this effort, and we're developing a media spot, TV ad, and then also something to put on a bus and at bus stops for students to engage them and inform them more about college opportunities. The second thing is that over the past year, our office received funding from the legislature to develop an accountability system for higher education. And we worked very closely with the four different, two public and two private college systems. We also worked with K-12 folks and then other stakeholders to develop the system. Our report should be out, I think, next week. We have 5 statewide goals and I think roughly 20-ish indicators. That there was lots of input. I think 80 people or so attended our 4 meetings, and then we had 20 meetings out in Greater Minnesota as well. But I'd be very happy to share that with your committee later. But we worked on that together as well with good input and participation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your input today and your seeds that you have planted with us on breaking down the barriers and seamless transitioning to the future. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Ornstein?
Yes, Madam Chair, I have read the minutes, and I would like to move them.
Representative Ornstein moves the adoption of the minutes as printed. Are there any additions or corrections? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are adopted for the meeting on February 5th. This meeting is adjourned.